the Civic Media Radio Network. Moving Wisconsin forward one joke at a time. This is As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Broad.
And so it goes. And so it goes. And so it goes. And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. Hello, Wisconsin!
Now, filling in for the new mom, here's Jane Matinair.
Good morning. Welcome, welcome, welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. So glad to have you along with us. Calvin is on the board. Greg Bach with me in studio. And I'm really excited to talk to our next guest. I saw this article in the Wisconsin State Journal. John Martin is a professor at UW-Madison. He is a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Good morning, Professor Martin. How are you? Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Jane. I'm great. How are you?
I guess I'm a little concerned about this article in, again, the Wisconsin State Journal. It says climate change has pushed Madison into a new zone on the USDA's plant hardiness map. And obviously, this is something that has been occurring over the last several decades. How worried should we be about this, Professor Martin?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think this is just yet another sign of the fact that there's a very gradual but persistent and systematic change that's ongoing in the world's climate. And that is affecting all kinds of different things. And now we see rather dramatically that plant hardiness is affected in a fairly dramatic way. We are substantially warmer in this current time than we were 30 years ago. And that warmness means that the wintertime is not as extreme. And that has, you know, ramifications for agriculture that are not negative per se. But the background warming is something that is going to start to affect lots of other things, both meteorologically, climatologically, and ecologically. And so, yeah, there's some concern there. We can't tell what all of the ramifications are going to be, but you don't like to go around poking hornet's nests knowing that there's something inside that doesn't like you very much.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've noticed this myself just over the last couple of winters. If I wouldn't take out like my snapdragons and they seeded, they would actually come up in spring. That's not supposed to happen. Snapdragons are not perennials. They're annuals, and they're not native to, and I live in Milwaukee, which granted, it may be a different zone than Madison, but still, it's like this, while great, and I love to see things reseed themselves, this is not a good thing necessarily.
No, it gets in the way of your plans. I mean, if you're a meticulous gardener, you expect certain behaviors from your plants, and you know, if they're annuals, you don't have to worry about them in the next year. You want to start again, or you want to replant or do something else, redesign your garden. And if you can't count on that, what you've counted on for your entire life, it starts to become a fairly substantial problem. And one that over which we have little or no control.
Well, and what does this do for Wisconsin's farmers, Professor Martin?
I think it might extend the growing season, might compel some of the agricultural interests to start a little earlier than they would otherwise. And then not yet plan, but actually in reality, start having harvests come in later than normal, or maybe get a second crop of various kinds of agricultural products in a season here in Wisconsin when it used to be prohibited. So it's going to take some adjustment. I suspect, since there's a commercial aspect to it, that the farming industry will figure out how to best deal with the new circumstances, but for a period of time, there'll be an adjustment that won't be comfortable and may well cause people to take risks that they probably shouldn't, or to hedge when they probably shouldn't. So it's going to be confusing.
If you're just joining us, John Martin is a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and we're talking about how over the last few decades, the hardiness zones have changed here in Wisconsin and all across the country. I'm just wondering too, Professor Martin, I mean, there are some crops in particular that absolutely have to have a certain amount of cold, correct?
I think that's right. I mean, I'm not an expert in botany or anything related to it, but I know that that's correct. And then also just thinking about it from the broad farming standpoint here in our own state, we used to be able to count on a pretty decent snow cover during the wintertime. And that not only protects the ground from deep freezing all the way to the really depths that you have to wait too long in the spring, but it also helps the soil to retain moisture. So if the soil's bare and uncovered by snow all winter long, there's still a lot of evaporation going on through the soil and sublimation getting that ice out of there. And so you begin the new growing season at a deficit of water, not just groundwater, but soil moisture. And so those are really substantial issues, and they're incrementally getting worse. And, you know, when the hardiness zones change, that's the implication is that there's something else about the climate that's changing. We're about 3 or 4 degrees warmer now than we, on average, degrees Fahrenheit, than we were, you know, sort of in 1990, 2000. And persistently over the 90 days of winter from December 1 through February 28, that integrates to something rather substantial in terms of snow cover and the ability for the soil to retain moisture. So there's lots of implications to these slow creeps in one direction. And people with a fairly dismissive attitude about a small temperature change are not thinking the problem all the way through.
I absolutely agree with you. It's, you know, there's always those folks who are like, yay, we had a mild winter. Wasn't that great? And I didn't have to shovel. And yes, that's all well and good. But as you said, we need a certain amount of snowfall for moisture purposes in spring.
Or even as I said earlier, people who will use that same argument as a way to push legislation or just push narrative that, oh, climate change isn't that bad. It's only a degree or two. And people in power say those types of things from their podiums and their, you know, their positions of power, and people believe them.
Right. Yeah, you know, our own Senator Johnson's made some ridiculous statements regarding that, in the notion that, hey, this might make Wisconsin warmer in the winter. Isn't
right.
that a good thing?
Right.
You know, it's absurdly stupid to not game the whole thing out and to think about all of the ramifications. And this is one of them we're talking about right now. How does it affect the growing season in the subsequent season? There's really big implications for a milder winter. And to act as if there's no problem at all, and it's actually a benefit that we've manufactured by our, you know, inattentiveness to the way we're changing our environment, is really foolish.
Well,
it doesn't deserve to be rewarded by a term in the Senate, if you ask me.
Well, and
amen.
Absolutely. And again, it's not even inattentiveness, I don't think. We've known about this, and certainly climate scientists have known about this for a long time. It was more ignoring the issue because we don't want to have to address the causes of this, because there might be some industries that will lose money.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And you know, you're exactly right, Jane. It's the willful ignorance part of it. Knowing better, but deciding to just blow it off anyway, which is, you know, absolutely the last thing public servants ought to be engaged in. And certainly it's frustrating for those of us who sit by and do our work every day, whatever it is we do. In my case, I learned something about how this system works. And to hear people in positions of power just dismiss the importance of that understanding is very frustrating.
Well, and
I can't imagine how infuriating that must be for you and your colleagues.
Well, and we mentioned this last hour, Professor Martin, about, you know, we'll always get one politician who will bring a snowball into the chambers and hold up the snowball and say, well, here's proof that there's no climate change because I have a snowball. And it's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. In fact, that week when Senator, I forget his name now, from Oklahoma, brought the snowball into Washington, D.C., that was the same week that Tammy Baldwin's office had somehow gotten a hand on a paper that I'd written, a scientific paper about how the cold pool in the wintertime over the whole Northern Hemisphere is systematically shrinking. So it's a clear signal that the globe is warming up. And then there's Senator Inhofe with a snowball on the floor of the Senate. Well, it's stunting. It's not governing.
Yeah. And, you know, and another thing we talked about earlier was the fact that, and, you know, I say this as a person who does recycle, who does try to make sure I do what I can to help take care of the earth. But for the longest time, they were really saying, well, you got to do these things, the people, you got to separate your recyclables and everything. And now we're finding out that it's really these huge companies that really needed to do the work years ago. And now it's almost, so I guess the question I have for you is, as individual citizens, what, or if anything, can we do besides like contacting our local politicians, our elected officials, saying you need to do something about this? I mean, is it really at this point out of our hands individually to do something about it?
It's discouraging to consider the prospect. But I have a firm belief, and it goes beyond just the science and the social behavior aspects. I have a firm belief that if you know something is right and you have a choice to do either the right thing or the wrong thing, if you consistently try and then most times succeed to do the right thing, that does make the world a better place. And if everybody's thinking that way, it changes an entire ethic about how we ought to approach each other and our responsibilities to each other, given our privileges. So I'm in a privileged position here. I get to talk to young people about science. I don't shy away from suggesting to them that what they're learning about science might make them better citizens as well. And especially in regard to these issues. And I think that's okay for me to do that. I think it's actually an obligation for me to do that. It's part of the Wisconsin idea to do that. And so that's one thing I feel I can do myself. But when I'm walking down the hall of my house, I turn the lights off if I don't need them on. Those are all things we can do. Mm-hmm. And they're little things. But I think the important thing about those actions may not be their physical implications on the climate system or on our economy, but they develop within all of us a habit to be critical of overconsumption, to be thoughtful and mindful about what we're doing every step of the way. And I think those things matter. And I think especially if you carry those ethics into a situation where you run across a person in power who says, those are a waste of time. They laugh at you and they say, why are you doing that? I think you can say, I don't think I want you representing me anymore. Mm-hmm.
That speaks to their the way they live their life and treat other people when they approach these types of topics with such disregard.
I think that's right.
And as you kind of inferred too, Professor Martin, it is about getting individuals. We're all individuals. That's great. Let's all celebrate our individuality. But again, we are collectively part of this planet. It's about all of us. Mm-hmm. And we need to get back to some of the do this for the greater good. Yeah. Not just because I want to take a 90-minute shower. Well, you know, okay.
And some people, too, it's like some of these politicians, and now we're getting into the political, which is fine by me. You talk about these politicians who are making it their end game to protect the children at all costs from everything, anywhere. Right. And these are the same people who are like, I have no interest in saving the earth. It's like as if they don't care about their children and their children's children. There's so much hypocrisy. They should be the first ones to say, we need to do something about this.
Yeah, very true.
It has been delightful talking to you. John Martin is a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Really appreciate your time this morning, Professor Martin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
Stay with us when we come back. Remembering Norman Lear and Time's Person of the Year. That's coming up on ESGO's Wisconsin across the Civic Media Radio Network. And welcome to ASGO's Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for listening in Madison on WMDX. Shout out to the listeners in La Crosse listening on the Eagle WLCX. Jane Matnair in for Kristen Rye. Greg Bach with me in studio. Calvin is on the board. You can always join us at 844-967-2789. Or if you're watching on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, you can leave comments there as well. 101 years old. Norman Lear, television pioneer. And I saw something this morning that's mentioned he was born before TVs were even invented. Norman Lear is gone at the age of 101.
Giant is too small of a term for that man. Literally changed the course of television history.
Absolutely.
And not just in the entertainment that he provided as far as just good old fashioned comedies that made you laugh, but like those were shows that made you think and talk and come to self-realizations about and open up yourself to new people. And, you know, I mean, let me just list off some of the titles. Different Strokes. Mary Hartman.
Oh, my gosh.
One Day at a Time. The Jeffersons. Good Times. Maude. Sanford and Son. Those are just some of, the, some of the most popular ones, and they all had messages within them. They all had some sort of, you know, whether we're talking about feminism or we're talking about black excellence or we're talking about racism, whether we're talking about family and all those things coming together, it was just, he was an amazing human being, period. And, you know, he's one of those guys like Mel Brooks, he's getting up there in age, and like, you're not going to be surprised,
right?
But you're not going to be less heartbroken about it either.
But I think too, as you pointed out, all the things that he did, one of the best ways to remember someone like that is to look back at what they created.
Oh God. Yeah.
And as you mentioned too, Greg, he really did change the course of television with those kinds of programs that still used humor to address some really serious things.
Oh my God.
And, and turned a mirror on some pretty unsavory behaviors.
I mean, just a show like Archie Bunker, some of the most, like, it's hard to put into words how important that show was.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, and not to mention the fact that, like, from Archie Bunker, you get the Jeffersons. From Jeffersons, you get Maude. From, you know, not only just from good television, but, you know, opening up the doors to this family, who is a family we all know. They were our dad and mom. They were our grandma and grandpa, our aunt and uncle. And they spoke in real terms. And I don't want to say that in the 70s they were more comfortable with it. Maybe there was just less.
There was less of a spotlight on it.
Less of a spotlight. So saying some of the words they said on television back in those days, I don't want to use the word sensitive. That's just not what I'm going to do here. But it really just opened the doors for what television could become and what you could say and your motivation and giving opportunities to different writers and different producers.
Absolutely.
And actors who got their shot from these shows. I mean, he was just important and he was gigantic and I loved him so much and I loved listening to him talk. He was so about artistic expression and freedom and license. I was telling you before, in 2000, he, along with some other people, purchased an original copy of the Declaration of Independence. And I found out what they did with it.
Oh, wow.
They sent it on, first of all, they paid $8.14 million for it.
Wow.
They sent it on tour across the country so people could see it.
How cool.
And when I saw his interview where he showed it to the interviewer, he opened up this big case with it and he spoke from the heart about the importance of the document. I could not stop crying because I'm like, artists, creative people, you know, you can have a lot of discussions about the history of this country, about the goals and whatever. But as far as art goes, there is a certain sense we look at these documents and we can say, we live in a country we can say these things on television. And if someone tries to come for us or someone tries to shake a fist at us or shake a finger or whatever, no,
we're there protected.
It is. There
protected.
It is. There it is. Yep. So Norman Lear, very, very, very much going to be missed. And
it's been great seeing some of the tributes come in from comics on my Twitter feed. John Stewart said, Norman, thank you for raising me. Rob Reiner said, you know, essentially Norman Lear was his second father.
Yeah.
And just a very, very impactful human being in entertainment and just for humanity. Norman Lear, gone at the age of 101. Just a couple of minutes for another shout out to Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
Jane Mattenair.
Not even close. Aww. Well done, 33-year-old Taylor Swift.
Who's surprised?
Oh, I think there are some people who are surprised.
They're haters. Shake it off.
You are not wrong. But look at what she has done. She has changed.
The way you said it, I can't tell if it was good or bad.
No.
Look at what she has done.
Look at what she did. She affected global economies.
Yeah.
With her tour.
She registered people to vote.
Got thousands of people to register to vote.
There are very important artists in this time. And if you can't include her in that, then your reasons for not are selfish. Like, you don't have to like Taylor Swift's music.
No, you don't.
A couple years ago, I didn't care about her music. I love her music now. And I love the way she treats her fans. And I love the way she's tongue-in-cheek. And she just, She kind of doesn't give an F. And that's important, but she speaks on important topics too.
Yes.
So, I mean, I do it, Tay Tay.
And don't, I mean, she started when she was like 14 years old.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. She's been recording records for nearly 20 years. And that's weird.
Cause she's only 33.
Yeah. If you ask me how old she was, or like, you're like, oh, she's been around for like what? 5, 10 years.
Oh
no. Sorry. Don't come at me, Swifties. They are not people out there. They're mean. Those are meanie peoples. They are. They can get really mean. You can just be like, hey, I didn't really like 1989 as much as Midnight's. Oh, no. I got to sell my house and move.
They have very strong feelings.
Well, maybe they should channel those feelings into helping.
All right. Well done, Taylor Swift.
Good job.
Coming up, big, big breaking news from yesterday. Dane County judge handing a victory to abortion rights supporters after ruling the 1849 law does not prohibit abortions. So coming up next, Michelle Velasquez of Wisconsin Planned Parenthood is going to be joining us to talk about what this means, what happens next, what's going to happen next with courts and all of those things. So stay close. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin across the Civic Media Radio Network. Good morning. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us. Jane Matinier in for Kristen Bride. Greg Bach with me in studio. Calvin is on the board. And some big news came down yesterday. A Dane County judge handing a victory to supporters of abortion rights yesterday, ruling that that 1849 Wisconsin law does not prohibit abortions. And we're so happy that she was able to join us last minute. She is with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Michelle Velasquez is our guest. Thank you so much, Michelle. I'm sure you guys have been very busy since this was announced yesterday. So thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So what does this mean, Michelle? This decision by this judge in Dane County, what's going to happen tomorrow? What's going to happen next week?
So, you know, this decision is really what we at Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin were anticipating. And as many folks know, we resumed abortion services back in September. And we did that really based on this judge's some prior decisions and rulings that came out earlier this summer that are really consistent with that final ruling and order yesterday. But just because Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin resumed doesn't mean that this decision doesn't have major impacts around the state. It absolutely does. What this decision does is, you know, hopefully provide providers and healthcare systems around the state with the reassurance that they can now treat their patients with the full scope of reproductive and sexual healthcare without fear of prosecution. And that's really the most important thing, is that people have access to this really essential healthcare. As far as what happens next in this case, it will really depend on whether any of the defendants decide to appeal this court's decision. And I'm sure that we will know more about that in the coming days and weeks. I know that one of the defendants, the district attorney, Joel Armansky from Sheboygan, issued a statement indicating that while he respects the court's decision and will, of course, abide by that order, He intends to appeal that decision. So that's his stated intention, and we'll see what the coming days and weeks bring with that.
I think it's really important for people to remember that under this 1849 law, there were no specifics as far as how close to death a mother had to be in order for them to say she needs this procedure to save her life. So none of those specific things were codified. And at least to me, that's what made this so immensely dangerous. Because there were no parameters, right? There were no parameters, no solid parameters for our medical professionals to work within.
That's absolutely right. So this law was originally passed just a year after Wisconsin became a state, before women could vote, before the advances in medicine that we see and know today. So obviously it's a very antiquated and archaic law. And even with that exception, physicians around the state during that sort of year in a few months post Dobbs, before Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin resumed and before this court's decision, really grappled with what does this mean. And so the impact of that, you know, because some folks would say, well, there's an exception and you can provide an abortion to save a patient's life, but at what point is it legal? And so that really had this chilling effect. And we know that abortion bans and heavy restrictions lead to terrible health outcomes for the pregnant person, and disparately impact Black women and other women of color as well.
Michelle Velasquez is our guest. She's with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, talking about the decision that was announced yesterday by a Circuit Court Judge Diane Schlipper, essentially saying that the 1849 Wisconsin law does not prohibit abortions. And as you were saying, Michelle, at least in the Wisconsin instance, there were these exceptions for the life of the mother, but they were never codified. I think it's crucial for people to recognize in states like Texas, and where they have no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the mother, there are horrifying stories coming out of these states about women being told at 4 months that their fetus is not going to be viable. It lacks whatever, you know, it lacks a brain. Its lungs are not developing. And they have to carry that to term.
Absolutely. These, again, bans, just bans and heavy restrictions make pregnancy even more dangerous than it already is. I think there's this sort of idea that, you know, pregnancy isn't really a big deal and you carry a child for 9 months and then you have a baby and everything's great and lovely. And, you know, for some people that's certainly the case, but pregnancy is actually statistically a more dangerous than obtaining an abortion is. Abortions are safe. They're, you know, people, it's an outpatient procedure or a procedure done just through the use of medication. And so it's healthcare. And you're right, there are states where there's no exceptions. Wisconsin, under that 1849 law, only had an exception to save the life of the pregnant person. Again, exactly what that meant, we didn't know. There were no exceptions for rape or incest, no exceptions for other dangerous health conditions. Sometimes the fetus is incompatible with life outside the womb, as you were mentioning. And so it's really just forcing people to continue with pregnancies that are non-viable and that are going to negatively impact their physical health, and also forcing people that have carry pregnancies assume the risks, even in situations where the person has already determined, I am not able to care for this child, regardless of existing health conditions. They have made a choice for themselves that they cannot, for whatever reason, have a child. And so bans and restrictions obviously put people in positions of having to carry and have children that they would otherwise have not had.
I keep thinking of this one particular case in Texas, Michelle, where, again, her fetus was not viable. She was going to have to carry it to term. Ultimately, I think she got sepsis and ended up having to get a hysterectomy, which meant that she could never have any more children. And when she tried to join a lawsuit against the state of Texas, they essentially said, well, you no longer have standing in this because you can no longer have children.
Yeah, it's absolutely mind-boggling, and I, you know, wish I could say I'm surprised, but I'm not. We've seen, you know, this is really a culmination of 50 years of really strategic activism from the anti-abortion, anti-choice movement to chip away at abortion access. And right after Dobbs, one of the attorneys in that movement really publicly stated this was the midpoint. The longer term goal is to ban abortion nationally. And so we see this happening even in places like Illinois and Minnesota, where abortion has always remained accessible and legal post-Dobbs. We see this in the form of these federal lawsuits that challenge the FDA's approval, for example, of mifepristone, which is the drug used. It's the first medication used in a medication abortion. It's the medication that I think about 98% of all medication abortions use. That's the first drug. And then there's a second medication called misoprostol, which can be used on its own. Mifepristone is the preferred regimen. And we see these lawsuits at a federal level really challenging, again, that medication, which could undo and create sort of a more tangled web of accessibility in states that have chosen to remain safe, accessible states.
Well, and I find it so interesting, too. And I mean, originally, the whole argument was states' rights. It has to go back to the states. Every individual state should decide it's states' rights. Until now, we have some presidential candidates who are going, oh, no, we want to do this nationwide. So that whole premise that this was a states' right issue just got tossed out the window.
Yeah, I mean, the Dobbs decision certainly would indicate that the idea is that this goes back to the states. But yes, you're right. We certainly see folks who would like to ban abortion at the national level. And, you know, sort of similar to the 50 years of sort of leading up to the Dobbs decision, there will be continued challenges to existing laws or protections, such as the mifepristone, for example, just sort of a gradual attempt to chip away at the accessibility that there is, which is why I always tell people restoring access, protecting access, and expanding access is a marathon. There has to be a really long-term strategy. This isn't going to happen overnight, and we have to remain sort of poised to continue in this fight for the long term. Certainly here in Wisconsin, I'm sure other states obviously as well. And this case and decision yesterday, I know it is a long time. It's over a year since Dobbs. We're almost at a year and a half. And it is something that we're celebrating. We're thrilled. And we know that it's not enough, because Wisconsin essentially reverts back to the legal framework that we were providing abortions in prior to Dobbs, which was very restrictive. It is very restrictive. Wisconsin is considered one of the more restrictive states pre-Dobbs. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. We don't have a enshrined state constitutional right to abortion at this point. We don't have a statutory right to an abortion at this point. And we have just a slew of laws and regulations that make accessing that care extremely difficult.
Going back to something that Jaina just said about politicians and whomever wanting the national abortion laws, something that I've been noticing, especially in the Republican debate, Nikki Haley went on record as saying that she wasn't for it based simply because the improbability of getting it through all the way. And I feel like that, like, I see a lot of politicians not really saying, there's someone who danced the line really well, because we're seeing individual states like Kansas pushing back, saying, no, we don't want what you're trying to push. And it just seems to me that the pushing of a national abortion ban is just, it's going to be so much harder than I don't know how to frame the exact question, but like these politicians, it just seems like they really just want it, but they're lying about it on the podium. Essentially,
they would never lie.
I know they're so nice.
They would never lie.
Yeah.
Michelle Velasquez is our guest from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, talking about the decision yesterday by a circuit judge in Dane County that the 1848-1849 law does not affect abortion. Michelle, do you have the time to stick with us through the break?
Sure.
Wonderful. I got a couple more questions, and I want to go back to, especially you're talking about, it is still, there are still lots of hoops for women in Wisconsin that they have to jump through in order to get this health care. So we'll talk about that a little bit more specifically when we come back. Stay with us. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. Jane Matinere in for Kristen Bry. Calvin's on the board. Greg Bach with me in studio and joining us on the stream from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Michelle Velasquez is our guest, and we're talking about yesterday's decision by Dane County Circuit Judge Diane Schlipper that the 1849 Wisconsin law does not prohibit abortions. And we were talking just before the break, Michelle, that there are still many, many steps that women have to go through in Wisconsin before they are able to get an abortion, correct?
Absolutely.
And what I mean, there's still a waiting period, right?
Yeah. So, you know, for example, there's a 24-hour waiting period. So what that means is someone comes in for an appointment, it has to be in person. So they couldn't do a first appointment by telemedicine. They have to go in, see the physician. And the reason they have to be in person is because the law requires a physical exam. It requires an ultrasound, even if the ultrasound isn't medically necessary. There is state counseling that's mandated, and that is a script from the state that is physicians are required to go over with the patient. And then the patient will need to come back at least 24 hours later for their appointment. And so realistically, the appointment isn't going to be exactly 24 hours later.
Right.
It may be later that week. It might have to be the following week, depending on schedules. If the patient is obtaining an abortion through the medication, they have to see the same physician that they saw for that first appointment, which makes it really difficult to provide medication abortion services, particularly in more rural areas where there are just frankly, there's fewer people, so there's fewer physicians available, and there's even fewer for women's health. Those are just a few examples. Another major barrier is the cost of an abortion. And so people's insurance, depending on the source of it, may not be able to pay for that care. So if anyone is receiving a form of state Medicaid, whether it's Badger Care or a form of state Medicaid called Family Planning Only Services, none of those would be able to
cover this.
Pay for the abortion. If you are a public employee and you are receiving your insurance from the essentially the government as your employer, right? That insurance could not pay for an abortion. If you buy your insurance on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, that cannot pay for your abortion. So there are these financial barriers, which are really significant. And, you know, sort of statistically, I think we're around 63% of people in this country couldn't cover an unexpected cost of about $500
right.
or more. And so that is just the reality that people are living in. So those are just, you know, some of the barriers that people face trying to obtain what is routine medical care.
As you were going through those hoops that women have to jump through, all I could think of was, I would love to see how a man would react if he went in to see his doctor for whatever and had to go through the same amount of hoops in order to get health care. The outcry would be unending. You're going to do what? I have to come back in 24 hours. What? I'm not capable of making my own decision. What?
Absolutely. There's no other form of health care that's really regulated and restricted like abortion care is. The other thing I wanted to add is that advanced nurse practitioners also cannot provide this care. So they're not doing the initial consult with the patient. They're not providing the medication. And this is Wisconsin. This looks really different in other places, particularly
sure.
our neighbors in Illinois and in Minnesota. And permitting advanced nurse practitioners to sort of practice under the full scope of their license, which they prescribe medication in every other scenario, except for like really specific types of controlled substances, permitting them to use the full scope of their license would be another way to expand the availability and access folks have to abortions.
And I think it's important for people to keep in mind, and I had done an interview with Wisconsin Right to Life probably 35 years ago, and they said then that the goal was to ban contraceptives, all contraceptives, ban all abortions, and that will also then spill over into IVF and those kinds of treatments as well. Don't think they're not still gunning for that stuff, to ban that stuff. That is part of the overall goal.
Absolutely. I think, you know, this is about abortion, but it's about so much more. It's about these fundamental rights that we should have as human beings to control our own bodies, to control our futures and the course of our lives. And that includes contraception. That includes who we want to marry. And these are the sort of privacy rights that the Dobbs decision really sort of calls into question. And I know that, you know, in the decision, some of the justices sort of said, well, we're not talking about those things. But Justice Thomas was not shy about saying, well, actually, this could apply in those scenarios as well.
Right.
It's not so long ago that contraception was, you know, very, very regulated as well. Women who were not married couldn't obtain it. Women who were married couldn't obtain it without their spouse's permission. And that was in the 60s and early 70s. So it's not that long ago that contraception itself wasn't particularly available to everybody. So those types of things are not necessarily settled. The other side is absolutely coming for those access to contraception as well. And so that's why I say, again, this is a marathon and not a sprint.
Thank you so much again, Michelle, for taking time to join us today. I know there's been a lot going on. Michelle Velasquez from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin has been our guest, talking about yesterday's decision from Dane County Circuit Court. Really appreciate it. I know we will talk more as the months go on. So thank you again. Stay tuned. The news is on the way next, followed by the wonderful Todd Alba program from noon to 2 o'clock. Keep it close. Keep it here on the Civic Media Radio Network.